Welcome to Better Cybersecurity, the ISF podcast. I'm your host, Steve Durbin.
ISF Chief Executive Steve Durbin is an expert in leadership, business culture transformation, and cyber strategies for today's top enterprises. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. In today's episode, we welcome another ISF veteran, journalist Jeff White. The last time Jeff was a guest on the podcast, it was 2024, and he had just released a book about how the tech industry launders money for criminal organizations. Today, Jeff comes on to talk about the latest installment in his podcast series, The Lazarus Heist, now known as Cyberhack, in which he dives deep into ransomware attacks. Steve and Jeff discuss the changing nature of ransomware attacks, how AI is used, crypto and ransomware laundering, and the importance of businesses having a plan to deal with an attack when it inevitably comes.
Good to see you, Jeff. How have you been?
Quite busy, but generally speaking, well.
Good, excellent. Now, for people who haven't listened to previous podcasts that we've done, you're an investigative journalist and you cover organized crime and technology. Now, in the past, you've reported on things like the Snowden leaks all those years ago, investigated, you know, the hacking of Britain's largest internet service provider, TalkTalk, exposed fraud in the online dating industry, and you've won multiple awards around those sorts of things. The last time we spoke, you were working on your book, Rinsed, which was about high-tech money laundering, where you'd uncovered how technology has revolutionized the industry, you know, from things like drug cartels washing their cash in Bitcoin to organized fraud gangs recruiting money mules on social media. It's been out, I think, for almost a year. What's been the impact?
It's been really interesting seeing the sort of themes of the book and seeing how they've run, particularly given the changes in the US political scene. At the time I was researching and writing the book, this was largely prior to Donald Trump's election and then inauguration. And so we've seen, for a start, the fact that technology feeds into money laundering and is a huge sort of force multiplier for the world of money laundering, particularly around things like cryptocurrency, but also around things like video game currencies and so on, and NFTs and all those sort of new forms of finance. That has not stopped, absolutely not stopped. What has been interesting to see is the shift around how the US administration sees these kind of fringe technologies and the people behind them. I mean, from almost the earliest days, we saw changes in the legal position. We saw the pardoning, for example, of Ross Ulbricht, who created the infamous dark web site known as Silk Road, was released from prison. We started to see pardoning of other people, CZ, who runs Binance, chief executive there, who'd been sentenced. So we started to see shifts around pursuit of cryptocurrency mixers. So these are entities that take in crypto like Bitcoin, mix it with other people's Bitcoin, and then spit it out to fresh wallet addresses. Obviously very useful if you're trying to launder money, useful for other things as well, though. Again, the administration starting seeming to row back on prosecutions of those sort of crypto abuse systems that could be used to abuse crypto. So yeah, the way the whole administration's bedded in and how that's impacted on that tech money laundering scene, I think has been super interesting.
Yeah. What sort of effect has that had on the money laundering industry?
What's interesting is it's still going on in cash. I mean, Oliver Bullough does a great deal of work on money laundering, financial crime and corruption, more the sort of corruption kind of end of the stuff that I look at, and has put out a book recently and talks about the impact of money laundering and talks about the quantity of cash that's still being generated in the world. So there's still a huge cash element of money laundering. Let's not take that for granted. But what we've seen, obviously, is growing interest in crypto, a growing stock of crypto. Just the volume of crypto use in the world has gone up. I think it's now something like 10% of UK adults now have a crypto asset. 10 or 12% is the figure I see. So you know, might not be much Bitcoin, but I'll have maybe a bit of Bitcoin or Tether or Ether or whatever. And so we've seen this adoption. That just gives money launderers more volume to play in, more smoke to hide in, as it were. The bigger the crypto world gets, the more opportunity there is really for launderers to get in there and stay under the radar.
Right. Now, you've got a new project going with the BBC, which tackles another kind of cybercrime, ransomware attacks. Tell us a little bit about that. What's a ransomware attack look like today, you know, step by step?
The fundamentals of it are the same, Steve, right, as you've talked about on the podcast a lot. You know, break in, hack in somehow to an organization, usually an organization, sometimes an individual, scramble the data, and then charge them a ransom to unscramble it. One of the few positive things about ransomware is the easiness with which you can explain it. It's probably the world's simplest cybercrime to explain.
And pretty well understood as well, isn't it? I mean, lots of people, you know, when we say ransomware, if we went back just a few years, the level of understanding of what we're talking about wasn't there. But I mean, the sort of general public awareness now is certainly up there.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. The understanding is there, you're right, and the mechanics of it hasn't changed. Obviously, we've had a few innovations, one of which being we're called double dip ransomware. So the idea that you don't just scramble someone's data, you steal a bunch of it first. And that way, if they refuse to pay or if they restore from backup data, you've got another piece of leverage to get them to pay the ransom. Right. So that's been created. But what's been interesting is a couple of things. Firstly, the industrialization of this industry. In the same way that as industries mature, they become more separated and more diverse and more layers, more programmatic in the way they do this. We've seen the ransomware industry do that. We've seen the ransomware industry hiring corporate due diligence experts, effectively, who will give them a dossier. And I've seen some of these dossiers on a target to say, here is the chief executive, how much they earn. Here's the chief financial officer, how much they earn. Here's their kids, their social media, their Facebook accounts, and so on, effectively compiling a dossier. That gets outsourced now, from what I've seen, to individuals who are just good at doing corporate research. And actually, that is probably not illegal in itself, but that dossier is handed over to, obviously, the people who are the initial access brokers. Again, another group within this ecosystem who break into targets, sometimes using reused passwords, sometimes passwords that have been leaked in data dumps, getting a toehold inside a victim. The initial access brokers then sell that on. There's then the sort of scoping team who work on the target and work out where they're going to put their ransomware for maximum effect, how they can scramble the data on the whole network. Then you have the negotiators who kick in and start negotiating with the victim. And again, have to have good English skills, have to be psychologically quite switched on. So again, that's another team of people doing it. And then, of course, at the end of it, you have some kind of cash out, some kind of money laundering. The victim transfers crypto across to you. If you have it transferred straight into your dodgy Bitcoin wallet that you've set up, that's going to be traceable and potentially seizable and recoverable. You might lose your money. So again, there's a money laundering layer which shifts onto this. And I think this is the thing. We are seeing the industrialization, the massive industrialization of ransomware, fueled by more than a decade's worth of profits from the ransoms that the victims have unfortunately paid.
Now, you mentioned double dipping there. There's also triple extortion going on, isn't there? You know, with encryption, data exfiltration, and then denial of service or just client harassment.
Yeah.
From an investigative standpoint, does this shift that you're seeing in the industry, if you like, make it harder to follow the money? Or does the increased complexity of the crime actually leave a longer digital trail for people such as yourself and indeed law enforcement?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. The podcast that I'm making for the BBC at the moment, so it's going to be out in spring of 2026. One of the things we're looking at is these leaks, these massive data leaks from within side ransomware gangs, and particularly looking at one of the big ransomware gangs, Conti, and leaks from that gang. Absolutely astonishing information contained in those leaks. The insight is great on so many levels. There's this great mundane day-to-day insight of how these guys, it's generally guys, get on with each other. The family relationships, the interpersonal relationships, and so on. But there's also fantastic insight in those leaks into how this industry, this particular business within an industry, in this case, Conti, actually structured itself. I mean, it's 350,000 messages in these leaks, right? I've so far been through about 45,000, I think 47,000 I'm up to, one by one, eyeballing them. People say, well, that's mad. You know, why don't you use ChatGPT or something to do this? The reason I go through it one by one is, A, that's how I'm built. I'm an investigative journalist. But also, then you actually, you really feel like you're there. You really feel like you've understood the culture of this organization. And what they're obsessed with is stuff like recruitment. How do we hire people? Retention. How do we pay them enough and give them the conditions and perks they need to stay? What is our strategy? How are we going to evolve our strategy so that we get a bigger pipeline of successful extortion victims? These are the concerns of everyday businesses. How do you hire and fire staff? What's your business strategy for the next few years? It really is. It's not just a business. It is structured in such a way that it's like a business. So that gives me as an investigative journalist a really useful insight into the gang. I think for defenders, the listeners of your podcast, understanding this is a business and understanding you're not being attacked by a crime gang, you're being challenged by a business competitor is a really interesting way of thinking about this. This is like a hostile takeover. The crime gangs do not think of themselves as hackers. They think of themselves as a business. Your security was weak. That's bad news for you, buddy. Our security, our technology was better. So you now have to pay us. It's effectively like a corporate raider mentality. That's what comes across in these leaks.
It's interesting that you say that. In your experience, how many organizations, or what proportion of the defenders, if you like, are actually sufficiently savvy to view it in the way that you've just described? Because certainly a lot of people that I talk to still hark back to the old days of, you know, it's a cyber attack. They really don't seem to have been able to grasp, and we've been talking about this for a very long while, but they don't seem able to grasp the industrial nature of the attacker.
Yes. Look, the people in the cybersecurity industry defending against this work extremely hard under very challenging circumstances. Their day-to-day job is just dealing with this tsunami of stuff coming at them. I talk about the crime triangle when I do presentations about this. I talk about the crime triangle having victims and then villains and then defenders, good guys. And that's how we generally think of it. And that is, to a certain extent, true on one level, but that's just not how the adversary sees it. The leaks I've seen and the discussion I've seen, and I do chat to these ransomware gangs sometimes. They're on talks, they're on the dark web channels, so you can talk to them. And look, it may be BS, it may be delusional, I don't know, but it's absolutely true that a lot of the people I chat to see this as business. It's not victims, villains, good guys. It's competitors. They're all competing. Right. My ransomware gang, our technology is competing against your defensive technology. If you're running Carbon Black or something, well, we can get past that, making that name up. But, you know, and with the good guys, they don't see themselves as cops and robbers. They just see the police as challenge, as competition. It's like, oh, you know, our server got shut down. Oh, well, I guess we have to spin up a new one. It's not like, oh my God, the cops are onto us. It's like, well, you know, this competitor, the FBI in this case, they managed to take down some of our business. So we just have to spin more back here. It's this, I don't know whether it helps day to day with cybersecurity people, but as a reframing exercise in your mind of what you're facing, it might be worth going into, I think.
I think you're onto something there. I think it would help. And the reason I say that is that within the good guys, within those corporations, it isn't just about the cyber team. You know, it's the business as well. And I think for business leaders, they can probably get their heads around the notion of competitors better than the notion of bits and bytes and firewalls and, you know, having to invest in something on which you don't see a return.
Yeah.
So I think shifting it into perhaps that sort of, you know, these are your competitors now, it's different. The playing field has changed considerably. That could well help. What do you think?
I think you're exactly right. I think to follow this to its sort of logical conclusion, you go in front of the board and you say, you've given me, let's say, 50,000 for my cybersecurity budget this year. I can acquire these pieces of technology. That's fine. Our competitors, let's call it a ransomware gang, let's say Conti, made 156 million last year, and they're putting all of that into offensive technology. So the inevitable conclusion of that is that if we can't spend more, we are going to be outspent and outperformed by a business competitor, who in this case is a ransomware gang. I am slightly spitballing here, and I don't know how that conversation would work, but certainly as a thought experiment, it's an interesting one to have. And I want to also talk, you mentioned there about sort of people, process and technology and about how that sort of beds in. Again, I think the conversation often ends up in technology because a lot of people who work in the industry are technologists, and frankly, the idea of selling a box with flashing lights on it for 50 grand a year, you know, is something that's happened in cybersecurity. But from my experience with the hackers and the attackers, so often it starts with people and process. In fact, I think it starts with process. Look at this business. What do they do? Who runs what? Who's got the keys to which bit? Mm. You don't need a computer to do that almost. You need a paper and pen of like, here's the victim, here's the board and so on. And you start with the org chart of the business to work it out. That's where you work out your vulnerabilities. Then you go for people, right? So now we know that that department sits on all the money, but they're linked to this department that's less defended. Who's in that department? Mrs. X, Mr. Y are in that department. Can we scope them out? It's only then you go, which virus are we going to land on them? Then you go to technology. And I worry that the defender side starts with technology and thinks of people and process later. And the other thing, to go to your point, is those other bits of the business, your business development or business affairs or whichever bit of your company works out the processes behind you, behind what you do, they're going to be really important because that's where the hackers are going to be looking. They come to technology last, in my opinion. So again, it's a different way of looking at it.
Yeah, it is. Let's stick with technology for a minute, though, because I wanted to talk to you about the impact that AI has had. So, you know, initial access used to be the bottleneck for a lot of ransomware gangs. You know, they often had to rely on mass phishing, didn't they? Just dump a load of stuff and hope that something's going to crack. With the rise of generative AI and certainly agentic tools, are you seeing a measurable shift in the quality of social engineering out there?
It's a really good question. And I'm maybe running counter to a lot of the blogs people might have read from security vendors, because I'm not a security vendor. I did ask the ransomware gangs and I said, look, are you using AI? You know, is this really helping? Now, obviously, they're ransomware gangs. Are they going to tell me the truth? I don't know. But what I did get back from them was a fairly sniffy response of, we're using it a bit, but not target reconnaissance, maybe honing our emails, maybe. But the emails had already got a lot better. These gangs had invested in English speakers. Some of the people I've corresponded with in the ransomware gangs are clearly native English speakers or very good English speakers. Mm. So already the emails were getting better. Yes, AI will be used to tweak those a little bit. I can see instances in which for ransomware gang, AI is going to be very useful. If you think about the MoveIt breach, which was hit mm-hmm. with ransomware a little while ago, I think the Klopp gang was behind that. Vast number of victims. And the sense we got was that the people who'd attacked MoveIt software had too many victims. They just couldn't triage the stuff. There was too many victims. So some victims knew that their data had been compromised, but they never got a ransom demand or they didn't see the consequences of it. So for AI, running across those huge data leaks and working out what's the good stuff to hit somebody with. The other thing that you could do, I mean, one of the Conti gang's jobs was to hit the jeweler Graff, the diamond dealer mm-hmm. Graff. Yeah. And famously, to put Graff under pressure to pay, the Conti gang leaked a bit of the data that they'd stolen from Graff, which, whoops, included some details about the Saudi royal family, which obviously didn't go down well. So Conti apologized to the Saudi royal family and said, oh, sorry, didn't mean to leak your data. Again, as an AI experiment, running the AI across the data you've stolen and saying, what should we leak into the public domain? And by the way, is there any risky stuff in here we shouldn't leak? That probably would have saved Conti a bit of hassle. So AI can be used, probably will be, but I don't think at the moment it's being used en masse by ransomware gangs, by advanced cybercrime gangs. I don't think. Fraud is different. The fraud gangs are all across this. The AI for fraud is an absolute boom. I mean, it's AI, particularly generative AI, is fundamentally a deceptive technology. It makes you think a human has done something when they haven't. That's fraud. Fraud is deception, right? So for fraud, AI is a game changer. I think we're in a good place with cybersecurity, relatively speaking, where the defensive AI use is so strong and so well-funded and pumping so hard that make hay while the sun shines, get your AI defensive stuff in line, keep our advantage going, because I think the cybercrime gangs are a bit behind the curve there. They'll catch up, but we can get ahead of them a bit while they're still behind. That's what I think. That's my personal view.
Yeah, very similar, actually. I mean, you know, having just talked about them being like corporations, the way you've described it, not dissimilar at all from the way that ordinary businesses are really sort of experimenting with AI. So very, very similar story there. Let's look at laundering a little bit now. So with, you know, the recent crackdowns on mixers, you mentioned that, and certain exchanges, my perception anyway is that ransomware groups have had to get more creative with their cashing out strategies. Based on your research into the current crypto crime landscape, what is the new sort of frontier, if you like, for ransomware laundering?
Yes, ransomware laundering is an interesting one because as far as we know, still a lot of the activity is tracking back to the Russian Federation. Mm-hmm. There is obviously other ransomware going on, and it's not necessarily just a Russian Federation problem, but we know the most experienced gangs tend to be tracking back to Russian Federation. So basically, right. When the crypto, the ransoms is moving back, it's generally moving into Russia, and so you're laundering within Russia. We've seen the use of sanctioned exchanges, crypto exchanges like Garantex, the famous one Garantex, being used to move crypto in and out. And that's interesting because obviously if you run your money through Garantex and it's still traceable back to Garantex, you can't use it abroad. You can't go to a legit exchange and say, oh, I've got some Bitcoin from Garantex, I'd like to deposit it here. Because somebody outside Russia is going to say, hang on, that's obviously shonky money. I'm not going to take that. So it does raise this interesting question of how is Garantex still surviving? It's obviously still surviving, I think, along the internal market within the Russian Federation. So basically when Garantex receives crypto, buys and sells it, who's it buying and selling it to? Well, it's probably folks inside the Russian Federation and or entities that don't care that Garantex is sanctioned. So there's this interesting sort of picture emerging around, okay, we've sealed off things like Garantex, but they're still able to trade. So who are they trading with? I think what we're seeing is kind of the emergence of a sort of underground community of people who are buying and selling crypto, who don't really care where it's come from, or who think that if it's come from somewhere sanctioned, it's fine, as long as the people who've sanctioned it is people like the US that we don't agree with. What we're also seeing in the laundering space, which is really interesting, and I've done a lot of stuff on North Korea, and this ties in a bit to the North Koreans and how they launder.
Yes, because of course you studied the Lazarus Group for a very long while, didn't you?
Yes. And I mean, the Lazarus Group last year, their biggest job ever was the Bybit hack, another crypto exchange, from which they stole $1.5 billion, which, by the way, they transferred out in 1 minute 55 seconds. So that's the fastest theft of all time by a large margin. Now, when they got the crypto out, they obviously needed, where do you go with $1.5 billion of hot crypto in your back pocket? What we're seeing around, particularly around areas like Southeast Asia, is the emergence of this sort of netherworld of crypto scamming, of crypto casinos, prompted, I think, in large part by the fact that China has largely outlawed crypto for its citizens. Chinese citizens still want to buy Bitcoin and Tether and all these other things. Where do they go? They have to go now to the gray market. And so there's custom, people wanting crypto and to be involved in it coming from China. They're going to these quite dodgy places. And what that's creating is this sort of vortex where dodgy money can come in from things like ransomware, potentially things like Garantex, the North Korean hacks, can wash into that and be washed out to give crypto to people who otherwise wouldn't be able to buy it, partly because of the restrictions from China. So we're seeing this interesting trade emerging, which is pulling these things together. One last thing on that, there's a national agency operation called Operation Destabilize, which is fascinating. If you just Google that, it links ransomware money, ransoms, with an international laundering network, which spirals into all sorts of incredible places. So if you want a vision of where laundering goes in the future, and ransomware laundering, just Google destabilize and you'll get interesting insight from that.
Fantastic. You talked about sanctioned regimes there. I wanted to ask your view really on no pay legislation, which is being discussed in some countries. Do you think that will actually work, or is it just going to lead to sort of under the table settlements?
I hate this question because what it brings us face to face with is there is no good decision once you're hit with ransomware. Lisa Forte says in her presentations, and I echo that, cybersecurity person from Redgoat, there is no good solution. The best solution is just not to get hit with ransomware in the first place, which is why defensive technology and why understanding ransomware as an industry is really important. Don't get hit. But if you do get hit, look, I think what's interesting is if we could fast forward to a world where we'd outlawed ransoms and it was just done. I don't know, you introduce it and then suddenly you just disappear the next 6 months. And then we're in a future where ransoms were illegal in the UK. It would work. But the problem is that's not how it would go. Let's imagine as a thought experiment, the government, the UK government tomorrow introduces legislation and says no more ransoms, illegal, enforceable by criminal law, illegal, criminally illegal to pay a ransom. Immediately, you're just beset with problems. Hospitals, there's points where hospitals, to get the patients to survive, would need to pay a ransom. Are you prepared to let people die because you don't want to pay a ransom? Companies going out of business, which we've seen in the case of some ransomware attacks, Knights of Old, the UK haulage company. And then this issue of, well, how do you sort of enforce it? Who is keeping a track on all of this? And are you going to drag crime victims into court to prosecute them? Which judge is going to do that? So, as I say, as a thought experiment, the idea of outlawing ransoms makes perfect sense. None of us want to pay a ransom. These are horrible criminals. And believe me, I've found out more about them than I ever wanted to. But the problem is, you've got to, from that thought experiment, immediately fast forward to, okay, how would we bed this in? And so I think the middle ways of a register of those who pay, that's what that's getting into, is easing into the situation in the future where it's outlawed, but not going there immediately to try and just get people used to it. Because frankly, if we could say, look, the UK doesn't pay. I mean, if we could make that happen, that would be an incredible thing. We'd put UK PLC in the front seat because we could turn around to the rest of the world and say, we don't pay. That's the policy and it's working. It's really the only way of us cancelling ransomware, but it's so hard to do. It's so hard to do.
It is. And I think the only thing that I recommend to boards in particular when I'm asked that question is that you need to have figured it out now. You know, it's no good waiting until you've been hit and then calling an emergency board meeting to decide your plan. It needs to be part of your incident response. You need to have thought it through, looked at the different levels that will cause you to pay versus not pay, and understand, you know, the impact that it's going to have, not just on your operational business, but on things like reputation and indeed your customer base.
And by the way, from the ransomware gang's point of view, from the exposure that I've had to these gangs, they absolutely trade on that. Number one, they trade on the fact that business is basically shitting themselves when they're hit by ransomware and doesn't have a plan, doesn't know what to do. So they'll go in and say, clock's ticking, buddy, clock's ticking. We're charging you this much money. We know you insured for this much money so you can afford it. And by the way, we know your daily revenues are X, so we know exactly how much this is costing you. They are already at the point where you're trying to encourage the board to be. They already know how this is playing out. So for business, absolutely plan it out. And you're also right, that idea of which levels you will go to, how long you're going to wait until you consider paying, what level of data you'll try and recover before you make that decision, because sometimes you can get data back, what level of proof you will look for from the ransomware gang to say, what have you stolen? Because we had issues with the ransomware gang saying, oh, I've got 3 terabytes of your information, and actually what they've got is a couple of PDFs. So again, game playing this and not being caught on the hop, saying we may have to end up paying, but let's work back from that and work out where we have to step through to get up to that point. I think you're exactly right. And I hope boards listening to folks like you and others talking about it.
Now, you mentioned it much earlier on in the conversation about the gangs, you know, worrying about recruitment and retention and that kind of thing. I'm curious, what's the most surprising untechnical reason you've come across for why a person decides to join a ransomware gang?
It's really interesting. I mean, one of the stories that we're telling in the podcast is about a Latvian woman originally called Alla Witt, who has a really quite amazing story. She starts out in Latvia and she's older. She was 50 at the time she got arrested, and that was a few years ago. So she's not your classic sort of computer hacker, young guy in a hoodie kind of thing. And it's really interesting how she gets recruited, because obviously the ransomware gang, they can't go on freelancer.com or Monster and say, join a ransomware gang. So the way they did it with her anyway was they had a recruitment sort of conference. They invited lots of coders along to talk to them about how recruitment works, and like a job fair, effectively like an online job fair.
Yeah.
And at the end of it said, would you like us to put your CVs forward to some organizations? And of course, Alla said yes, lots of them said yes. And then she gets contacted by, spoiler alert, what turns out to be the Conti gang. But they didn't present as that. They just said, we're a software firm, we'll need some help with web development, we'll need some help with website design, we need an English speaker. And what's interesting is there were a lot of people like Alla who either don't ask as a matter of course, they just do some work for somebody. They might never even know the client. They're working through an agency.
Yeah.
Or they just don't care, as long as what I'm doing isn't obviously illegal. And that's how Alla started out. She doesn't end there, and had to listen to the podcast to find out where it does end. It goes some quite crazy places. But that's how you go in the shallow end. And actually, Conti had a lot of trouble with recruitment because they would get people on these Zoom calls and they couldn't tell them outright what the job was going to be and what they were going to be doing, which immediately you lose some of your candidates. And by the way, these candidates, they can apply for a legitimate normal job as a coder. They don't have to go to ransomware.
Right.
So not being able to be fully briefing them on what's going on. And then, of course, as soon as they do tip the wink and say, oh, by the way, this is a bit dodgy, again, you lose candidates. So Conti had the funnel, the recruitment funnel they had to have, had to be really big and broad, because they were going to lose people off the sides of it who just didn't want to join in this. And they could only step people through the funnel to a certain speed, because if you tell people right at the top it's going to be ransomware, they'll just back out or you'll get infiltrated by law enforcement. So the recruitment funnel and the recruitment process was really super intricate with Conti, and I suspect with other gangs as well.
Yeah. I mean, time's against us, Jeff, but I've got one last question for you. What surprised you about the world of ransomware attacks these days?
The thing that really surprised me, and again, this might be delusional, it might be BS, I don't know, was, I don't know whether you come across this term, Steve, post-paid penetration testing. You come across this?
No, I haven't come across that one, no.
That is how the ransomware gangs, some of them, describe themselves to me. Okay. What they're saying is, look, you would pay for a penetration test to test your security. You'd pay for that. Well, we've done one. And now we're confronting you with the results of it. And now you pay us. And it's fascinating because it, like I say, I think there's a sort of double brain thing here going on, a double think thing where somebody can think one thing and know another. They know they're doing crime. They know they're crooks. But they can present to the world and keep absorbing their own sort of BS and their own hype and say, we're just a business. That was the thing that I just saw and was like, post-paid penetration testing. God, I've never heard of that. And it just sums up the entire thing. It's a business and they're justifying it as a business. Remarkable.
It is. It is remarkable. Jeff, always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for sharing those insights. I'm sure that the listeners will have found that absolutely fascinating. You've got your own podcast. You've got this show with the BBC coming up. Lots of different ways I'm sure that people can listen to some of the insights that you've got. Thank you so much for sharing some of those over the last 25 minutes or so. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, Steve. It's really a pleasure to talk. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with more expert insights and thought-provoking discussions. But in the meantime, if you really enjoyed today's episode, please take a moment to rate, review and share the podcast. If you're interested in becoming an ISEF member, or continuing the conversation further, please do get in touch with me at steve.durbin@securityforum.org, or indeed get hold of me on LinkedIn. And remember, you can explore all our media and resources at our website, securityforum.org.